Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it that reasonable people find so many ideological issues to disagree about? And is there any hope that liberals and conservatives might find a way to come together or at least to understand one another? Part of the formula is moral intuition, the blink of an eye judgments we make about whether certain things are inherently good or bad. We experience these judgments as so unequivocally true that we have trouble understanding how any good and intelligent person could come to a different conclusion. Joining us to explain all this and its implications for politics, society, and civil discourse is Jonathan Haidt. He is professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU's Stern School of Business. He's also author of the new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So often our sense of moral and political values is that they just make sense. What do we miss when we assume that reason is at the core of our beliefs?
Well, our views in psychology about the mind, they've changed over the last century, and we went through a long period of Freudianism where we thought that the unconscious was in charge, and then we went through a long period of sort of rationalism and focus on reasoning. We thought reasoning was in charge. And now we're beginning to understand that most of the mind is automatic and unconscious, not quite in the dark way that Freud said, but we judge things very quickly. We feel emotions around them. And then our reasoning seems to function mostly to seek out justifications for what we've already judged. And so when we argue with each other, you know, you give me some opinion, I say you're crazy and here's why you're wrong, and amazingly, I don't change your mind, and I think, therefore, you must somehow be either stupid or insincere if you don't accept the logic of my reasons.
Yeah, there's that sense that if other people simply were presented with the same evidence that we had, that they would feel exactly as we do.
That's right. That's called naive realism. That is, we each have the feeling that we see reality clearly, and to the degree that people don't agree with us about something that's as plain as day, well, they must be simply wrong.
So how would you characterize the essential ideological difference between conservative and liberal views?
Well, the particular things that they fight about differ from era to era, and even decade to decade. My job as a psychologist, I'm a social psychologist studying the psychological foundations of all of this craziness. My job is to say, what's the psychological dimension on which people differ that leads some to move to the left and some to the right? And the main one is this dimension known as openness to experience. That is, some people just, and you can see this in kids, some people just, they like diversity, change. If something's new, they're going to try it. And other kids, they kind of prefer things to be a little predictable, stable. And so even from the behavior of kids in preschool, you can predict, not very well, but you can predict above chance whether people will eventually, in 20 years, vote Republican or Democrat. So that's the foundation, and that leads people to mix with different groups, maybe the goths for people who are going to go to the left, and maybe the jocks or the more conventional folk who are going to go to the right. And then our groups reinforce our own sort of mental predisposition.
We should note here that you recognize and you acknowledge that there is a broad continuum of political positions and ideological positions in the world, not simply left versus right. Why then, though, do so many issues end up split along these lines?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Because, thank you for pointing that out. So the main dimension of left-right does do an awful lot of work. People love to hate it. People love to say, people are so complex. There can't just be one dimension. Well, in the social sciences, our job isn't to explain every individual. Our job is to find the generalities that explain a lot of what we see. And so the left-right dimension does that. Now, there are libertarians who, my research group at yourmorals.org, we found that libertarians are more like liberals in their personalities, except that they're very low on compassion. So you could think of them as people who are, you know, liberals. They like change, variety, ideas, education, but they're not that compassionate. So they end up really loving free markets, and they don't mind so much that free markets have victims because they're amazingly efficient at producing wealth.
What tells you that the divide between left and right in American politics is wider today than it's been in the past? It seems like in every era we say it's never been so bad.
Yeah. So the basic history is important to know. I just learned this part of it in the last year or two. If you look at voting in Congress, at the degree to which there were party line votes and just nastiness across the aisle. The 19th century was really, really bad. I mean, the Civil War, it was a rather significant event in American history, and it was fought out in Congress, too. So things were terrible in the mid-19th century through the late 19th century. Then they got better in the early 20th century as the parties got all mixed up and the Republicans, you had progressive Republicans. And so we had this temporary period where the South was Democratic but conservative, where the parties were all mixed up, and there was a lot of ability to talk across the aisle from the 30s through the 60s. And then after Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act and the South started leaving the Democratic Party and becoming Republican, now the level of polarization in Congress began to climb steadily in the 70s, really, and it just kept going up, and it has kept going up, and it's now as high as can be. It's as bad now as it was in the late 19th century. So for people who feel, hey, it's getting worse, it's never been this bad, all I can say is you're right, unless you go back about 120 years. It was as bad 120 years ago.
And in this era, John, the conclusions we arrive at are less tied to actual self-interest than they might have been in the past. And that in itself would seem to be a pretty clear argument against reason being the primary driver of political persuasion.
That's right. This is one of the big things I'm trying to get across to people, especially on the left. I mean, I started this research as a liberal who was trying to help the Democrats, and now I'm much more of a centrist. But the thing that I think the left hasn't understood for a long time is that politics is much more like religion than it is like shopping. So you have Al Gore and John Kerry, and for a long time the Democrats saying, basically, vote for us because our programs will give you more than the other guy's programs, as though it's shopping and we got the better deal for you. And then the Democrats are also puzzled that the white working class vote Republican, and why are they voting against their self-interest? Well, because religion, first of all, I mean, politics is like religion. You have to look at what each side holds sacred, and then people circle around their sacred objects or values, and then they can't think straight about them, and that happens on both sides.
And if you hold something sacred, you're willing to sacrifice other things you don't care quite as much about.
That's right, exactly. So if you think that the federal government has already gotten way too big, and the 10th Amendment to the Constitution is pretty clear, I think conservatives who are concerned about the size of government have... there's a lot of justification for it, and you're already upset about wasteful government programs, and especially if you think some government programs help people who don't deserve it. That's the real key to understanding the Tea Party. If you think all of that stuff, and then you start rallying around the idea that government is bad, taxes are confiscation, well, before you know it, you're voting against all kinds of social programs, even if those might serve you in particular. People are idealistic, and this is not necessarily a bad thing.
So let's talk about how our views take shape. There is this fascinating interplay between nature and nurture as we grow in development, starting, of course, with genes. What physiological characteristics dictated by our DNA can play into the way we see the world?
Mm-hmm. So this is the big intellectual issue of the last 50 years has been understanding nature and nurture and understanding how you have to look at them both together. Because our DNA, our genes, we only have 20,000 genes. It's not many. And our genes don't really tell you how to build a body. They just start a biochemical process going. And this process fully expects a lot of input from the environment in order to lead to a fully functioning animal at the other end of the line. So for humans, we've got these genes. And there have been a few genes that seem to correlate with politics, very weak, but they're genes associated with neurotransmitter function, dopamine, a few other reward systems. So our genes build our brains, and then some people's brains, as we were saying earlier, some people's brains are just attracted to novelty and variety, and others like stability and predictability. So then these kids go and they have different experiences. They elicit different reactions from their teachers. So, the teachers might crack down on the little proto-liberal kid and, reward the proto-conservative kid. So we go through life, we find friends, we find peer groups, and then, in college, when you leave your family home, your parents, it turns out, don't have such a lasting influence on your ideology. It's your peer group has a more lasting influence. But when people get to college, they often shift around because they encounter all kinds of new ideas, and some of them just feel right. So even if you're two siblings raised in the same household, you go off to college, one of you is going to just really resonate to a liberal professor talking about oppression, and another will really resonate to a conservative professor. Not that there are many of those, but there are a few. Talking about the greatness of America and the importance of moral order and stability. Well, I guess not a lot of professors talk about that, but I think they should.
My guest is Jonathan Haidt. He's professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU's Stern School of Business. We're speaking this hour about his new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I am joined now for just a few minutes here by the senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, Jeff Whittington. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Chris, and hello to all of you. Thanks so much for being with us for Think today. This is a fascinating discussion. It's very timely, we're really excited and lucky to have Professor John Haidt on the show today. We are offering a copy of his book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. When you join the station with a $120 or more contribution today, you can make that a $10 a month sustaining membership on your credit or debit card or through a bank account deduction. It's very easy to do. Go online to kera.org and check it out, or call 888-694-6931.
Thanks to your support, we are trying very hard to make this among the very shortest full-scale fundraising drives that we have done on this station. We're trying to get this done in 9 days. Your support so far has been wonderful. If you still need to make your contribution, please do that now at 1-888-694-6931, or go online and make that donation at kera.org. It's so interesting, Jeff, the way the show comes together, thanks to your good planning. What John Haidt is talking about regarding the way the political parties changed after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that goes back to what we talked to Tom Frank about last week. Next week, we're talking to Stanley Fish about the ways that universities, in his opinion, should not have political perspectives whatsoever, and they should leave politics out of the classroom. And of course, this conversation today is something that we know many of you are interested in, passionate about, have a lot of questions about why we all can't just get along.
And you get a chance to interact with each of these guests on our program every single day. That's what we do. We make the show. We specifically make it so that you can call in, you can interact, and you can take part in the conversation. If that's worth something to you, and I think it is because you listen, you're listening right now, call us 888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org. Of course, we don't have knockdown, drag-out debates on the show because that's not what public radio really is all about. We want to feature a diversity of positions and a wealth of ideas, and we want to feature you. We want to take your calls. We want to hear what you have to say. But all this comes with a cost. We have to, we have to pay for the lights to be on. We have to work all the equipment and keep it in good working order and buy it in the first place. And we also have to pay for the phone call to call Professor Haidt for the hour. And he's giving his great time to be on the show today as well. So think about what that's worth and put a value on it and make that call or click and join at kera.org.
Think really is your show. We produce it right here in North Texas for this North Texas audience. Of course, we also now have a global audience thanks to our podcast. But what we ask is that those of you who rely on the show, who love Think, who come to it every day, perhaps at lunchtime, or who make time in the evenings to listen, or maybe you listen to the podcast every day, if this is one of the programs that you try not to miss, your support is vital right now. Please go online to kera.org and make your contribution, or call 1-888-694-6931. You can choose a thank you gift copy of Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind.
You can if you join at the $120 membership level, just $10 a month if you become a sustaining member of the station. And hey, that's about the average gift. Your fellow listeners, on average, give about $120 a year to KERA. We'll send you a copy of this book. Of course, it's out there available at your favorite retailer, but we'd love to be able to thank you. And we'd love for you to be able to support KERA and give you something in return. Again, the number to call, 888-694-6931, or do it online at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Haidt. He's professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU's Stern School of Business. His new book is called The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, John, a third element of all of this is our need as human beings to create narratives about our own lives and the purpose of our own lives. And in this arena, without meaning to be, it turns out most of us are incredibly selective about how we understand our own stories.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's wonderful research by a psychologist named Dan McAdams at Northwestern on how it turns out we begin to tell stories about ourselves in our teens. That's when our individual story begins coalescing. And teens are really struggling with issues of identity. And then as we were beginning to formulate that story, our world broadens. We think more about our country, about history. And we start listening for stories about how the world works and how society works and how our nation works. And we kind of sync up our own story with the story of our nation in some ways. That is, as kids are coming to choose whether they're a liberal or a conservative, they're trying to understand themselves and the nature of economic activity or political activity. And by the time they get out of college, or by the time they get through their 20s, we should say, they tend to have it sort of figured out. They sort of know who they are, and they have so, for example, the idea that, the world's a tough place, and people better be responsible and take care of themselves and their family, because if they don't, nobody's going to bail them out. And if someone does bail them out, well, they're just encouraging them to do bad behavior in the future. Well, that's a conservative story. And people embrace that story about the country would tend to endorse different values about themselves and their families. And so even if you start off similar to your sibling when you're teens, you can become very different people by the time you're in your 30s.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Kieran in the Colony. Hi, Kieran.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, earlier you were talking about how the genetics might cause a person to lean towards the left or to the right. But would the place where a person is, where he grows up or he or she grows up, does that influence? Because me being from India, I noticed that a lot of Indians that actually come into this country or whatever, even though they are conservatives or they have no influence with politics back in India, they come here and they actually lean towards being a Democrat. So what does that?
Which way do they lean?
Toward being a Democrat, he said.
Okay, follow up. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, no, great question. Because yes, people do change in adulthood, and so I think the way to think about it is this: that your parents aren't so crucial. It turns out correlations between parents and children are mostly due to genes, not to shared environment. But your parents choose where to raise you, and if you're raised in India, well, they don't choose your country, but where you're raised, you'll come to see things in certain ways. So I spent some time in India. It was very important for my own development. I spent 3 months in Bhubaneswar in eastern India, and just seeing the way kids will learn to show respect for adults, and the way they will learn to bow and touch their head to the ground or touch their head to the feet of a respected elder. These things come to feel very natural, whereas I was raised I'm Jewish, and I was raised in a very Jewish suburb of New York where we were all sort of smart aleck, know-it-all kids who were not very good at showing respect for authority. Those sorts of intuitions I think we do take with us into adulthood. And so I would guess that many Indians, when they come to America, they do resonate to some conservative virtues, although it might also be the case that the Indians who are coming here that you know, Kieran, I'm guessing they are probably more in the educated elite class, which does tend to lean left in both countries. Now, I'd be interested to know about Gujarati shopkeepers. Running a business tends to make people more conservative. So if you tell me that Gujarati shopkeepers and hotel keepers, if you tell me that they're Democrats, I'll be a little bit surprised.
I guess there's also the reality for some immigrants that maybe that tendency toward novelty seeking would lead them to be more liberal.
Well, that's right. And that's actually one of the theories. There's a lot of interesting theories about why America is so different from Europe. We're more conservative politically, and we're more religious in particular. And so, you know, who is it who came to America? Well, it was people who were interested in adventure. That's true, and so that would pull for some liberalism in some ways. But it also was a lot of religious people who were very religious and were looking for, looking for a home, a refuge. So it is possible that Americans are not representative of their home countries, and that our early immigrants sort of set the tone for us in certain ways.
All right, I want to talk about what you call moral foundations theory, and there are six essential elements to this. There's care versus harm, fairness versus cheating, liberty versus oppression, loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion, and sanctity versus degradation. How are these valued or discounted by people according to their political persuasions?
Mm-hmm. So my own empirical research, my experimental work, has been on understanding national differences in morality, including between India and the U.S., and around 2000 and 2004, when the Democrats lost races that many people expected them to win, I started looking at left and right as though they were different nations or different cultures. And I started trying to figure out, well, what are the innate foundations? What is it that we really have given to us by evolution, and then how does it develop differently? And why do people on the left and right just see the world so differently? And so, from reviewing research on evolutionary psychology to think about what's innate, and reviewing research on cultural psychology to look at how things vary, my colleagues and I came up with a list of six best candidates. And so the way to think about this is that they're like the taste buds on the tongue. So on our tongue, we have five different kinds of taste receptor, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. We all have the same five kinds, but we don't all like the same foods because we grew up with a cuisine. We grew up in a particular culture. And our palate got educated, you might say. But even within a culture, some people will like things spicy or less spicy, whatever. And so in the same way, all humans have a receptivity to these six kinds of moral issues. So, as you said, care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. But we grew up with different moral cuisines. As we were saying in India, there's just a lot more talk and thinking about respect and physical purity, group loyalty. So by the time you're an adult, your taste buds are the same, but your sense of taste is different.
Hmm. And so there are three that are really important to liberals, and yet conservatives you find are pretty responsive to all six of these.
That's right. That was our big discovery. It's building off of a work by an anthropologist named Richard Schwader originally. But what we found is that, everybody in America, and we've got data from all over the world at our website, yourmorals.org. Listeners can go take our tests. We found is everybody thinks it's wrong to, kick a dog in the head or be cruel to children. Everybody thinks that. But liberals are more concerned about those things. And liberals often say that morality is really about taking care of people. Many definitions of morality focus on harm or care. So that I think of that as being like sugar. It's one of the taste buds. And my 4-year-old son once said to me, however sweet something is, that's how much of a treat it is.
Hmm.
In other words, he meant, all I care about is sugar content. That's mm-hmm. it. And some liberals are like that. But then there's also fairness, and liberals do care about equality, but conservatives care much more about proportionality. That is, are you taking out in proportion to what you put in, or are you taking out more than you deserve? And that's what a lot of the Tea Party protests are about. They see government as being unfair in making some people, some people get more than they give, and vice versa. And then there's liberty. Everybody cares about liberty in America. But on the left, they see corporations and capitalism as the oppressors, and they see government as the only thing that can stand up to them. And on the right, they see the opposite. They see a long history of government getting stronger and stronger and passing more and more laws, many of which pushed by liberals. I do understand the anger of small businessmen and shopkeepers who have to comply with all these regulations about diversity and hiring and the environment. And there are good reasons for those laws, but I do understand how angry it would make someone to be told how to run your business. So everybody cares about the first three, but left and right vary somewhat. Then when we get to the issues about loyalty, authority, and sanctity, well, those are the ones where liberals are either ambivalent or they even reject them. Authority? You might respect a scientist as an authority if he's earned it, but I'm not just going to respect someone just because he's, a teacher or a policeman or some other position of authority. Group loyalty? Liberals tend to be universalists. They're quite ambivalent about nations and nation states sometimes. They like the idea of solving problems globally. But conservatives are more parochial. That is, they're more focused on their groups, and they value group loyalty much more. So in these ways, we find that the older culture war, all these issues about, you know, flag burning and protecting the flag and birth control and abortion, although I guess those issues are back, those are about the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phone now. This time we have Steve on the line in Carrollton. Hey, Steve.
Hello. I appreciate your discussion. It's intriguing. One of the observations I wanted to make in a follow it up with a question is you had referred to libertarians as lacking compassion, and I think that's kind of a sweeping generalization. And the question I had is, do you think that it's possible that compassion can be expressed in another way? In other words, we are concerned with people who are having their property taken away and given to someone who didn't work for it.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, that doesn't do the person that received it any good. It really is not helping them. It might make you feel good to hand them something, but it's been confiscated by someone else.
What do you think about that, John?
Oh, Steve, so thanks for giving me the opportunity to expand. I think I'm really intrigued by libertarian ideas. I think libertarians see some things that liberals and conservatives are just blind to, especially liberals. So let me just clarify. When people take our surveys at yourmorals.org and we see what they care about, libertarians talk very much as you did. And when I say that they're low in compassion, what I mean is liberals are bleeding hearts. Liberals will push all kinds of laws that lead to all kinds of unintended consequences as long as they think they're helping people because, look, they're suffering. We've got to help them. Libertarians turn out to be the most rational, analytical folks out there, more than liberals or conservatives. They are high on what's called systemizing. They're very good at thinking about complex systems. But they're lower than other groups on empathizing. That is, they don't quite put themselves in other people's shoes and feel what they feel. So I think libertarians are great as social analysts and as thinkers about complex systems, and they end up, I think, pushing for ideas and laws that really would work in the long run. But some people might get hurt in the short run, or at least you seem not to be taking care of people in the short run. So I think libertarians care a lot about society, and they want things to work right, and they've got great ideas how to make them work right. But if we return to the taste bud analogy, it's like the sugar receptor, you know, which in liberals is so, oh, we've got to help everybody who's suffering. That receptor is just not as active in libertarians. But the one that is really active is the liberty one. Libertarians turn out to have really one moral foundation primarily, which is liberty, just like they say. And libertarians will let other things go by the wayside in order to safeguard liberty. And there are very good reasons to do that. But I think it's not out of compassion that they do it.
Jonathan Haidt is with us. He's professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU Stern School. His new book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. If you would like to receive a copy of Jonathan Haidt's remarkable book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, we have that available for you today as a thank you gift when you go online to kera.org or when you call 1-888-694-6931 and make a contribution at or above the $120 level. Hello again, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And I just want to suggest for those of you who are listening who want to, you know, quickly access some of Professor Haidt's work, you might check out his piece, Born This Way, in the current issue, the May 2012 issue of Reason magazine, because that's actually the first place we saw
this topic.
That's
how we learned about the book.
Yeah, and so we learned about the book, and we were really excited and I think very fortunate to have him today. He's been really, really busy since the book came out, as you can imagine. This is a really timely topic. I think that many people are interested in what's going on politically and socially in our country. Obviously, the candidates are talking about it. The big candidates, you know, for the top tier gig that we're going to vote on in November, and it's worth an hour of our time. It's worth an hour of your time. After all, we're making this show for you, so we just want to know what it's worth to you. Is it worth a few dollars? And we're asking you to send money to the station. Hey, it's a big deal for us to ask you to send money to the station, but you know what? We're thrilled to be able to tell you our story and to ask you to call or to go online and contribute. The number to call, 888-694-6931. or click and join at kera.org.
One of our favorite things to do on the show, and you have responded well to it also, is to dive into complex issues that are not necessarily instantly boiled down to this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. Things that really are vexing. And I love nuanced topics and nuanced treatments of complicated subjects like we are seeing in Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, and in this discussion. We're proud to be able to bring this to you. Frankly, it is not the stuff of most commercial radio, most commercial television. Your support at 1-888-694-6931 and online at kera.org makes it possible to have a program like this where we talk about anything and everything under the sun. And we sometimes are left with as many questions as we have answered throughout the hour.
And if you're interested in supporting the station and supporting this forum that you participate in every single day by listening or by calling in, well, we hope you participate by supporting it with a financial contribution. And if you're interested in doing $10 a month in support of KERA or $120 all at once, well, thank you with your very own copy of Jonathan Haidt's book.
1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. And that goes for you as well, podcast listeners, whether you're listening to the broadcast in the middle of the day or at night, or if you are listening to the podcast, all the numbers work. The website is always open. So we would ask that you make your contribution as soon as possible. Help us make this one of the shortest full-length drives we have had in the modern history of this station.
Yeah, we've been listening to you. You've asked for shorter on-air membership campaigns, and we've had some great success the last couple of drives. In the fall drive, I think it was 4 or 5 days shorter. We did the January drive, this winter drive, in 12 days instead of the 24 it took us last winter. And then last spring, we spent about 18 days on the air, and our goal this time is to raise the same amount of money that we did in that drive, but in just half the time, 9 days instead of 18. But what that means is that we need to hear from you sooner. Don't wait. Do it right now. Call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
The credit for these shorter drives goes entirely to you who have been so responsive to our requests. The sooner we can raise the funds, the sooner we get back to full-time programming that we know you value. Please make your contribution now online at kera.org, where you can also check out thank you gifts, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931. Back in just a moment with Jonathan Haidt.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jonathan Haidt. He's professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU Stern School of Business. His new book is called The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. So, John, if conservatives really respond to all six elements of the moral foundations theory and liberals really are most committed to three of them, how does that affect the way each side understands the perspective of the other?
So what we found in a study that I did with Jesse Graham and Brian Nozick, we asked people who visited our website, yourmorals.org, to fill out our questionnaires as themselves, or a third of the time to fill it out as a typical liberal would, or to fill it out as a typical conservative would. And what we found was that conservatives and centrists were pretty well able to guess how liberals and everybody would fill them out. But people who were liberal, especially people who said that they were very liberal when they registered at our site, those people were the least accurate. People on the far left think, you know, when they're faced with a question, cruelty to animals is among the worst sins. You know, the people on the far left think, well, conservatives don't care about that. They like hurting people. They like hurting defenseless creatures. So they were not very accurate. And I think this mirrors the fact that the left is always asking, why the hell are they voting this way? What's wrong with Americans that they're doing this? The left is always puzzled as to why more Americans, twice as many Americans, identify as conservative compared to liberal. But the right is not so puzzled. The right doesn't have these problems. So I think that our experience as a nation bears out the fact that the left is perennially puzzled by the American electorate, and the right knows how to connect with it.
We should also say here that you believe that a strong nation, as we hope ours will continue to be, has every one of these kinds of people. You feel like we need conservatives, you feel like we need liberals, you feel like we need libertarians.
That's right. And that's been the real revelation to me. So I started this research because I was just so frustrated with Al Gore and John Kerry and their inability of their campaigns to really press the right moral buttons. And I wanted to basically help the Democrats. But in doing this research, and in trying for years to understand conservatives and then explain them to liberals, and then more recently to understand libertarians, I've come to see that it really is much more like yin-yang. It's you know, you need a force pushing for change and progress and concern for the vulnerable, and that's what liberals do. But then you also need a force pushing for order and structure and stability. You must have a force pushing to make sure that bad deeds get punished, and conservatives are much more concerned about that than liberals. And, you know, you've got both sides here using government to accomplish their ends, so you need the libertarians coming in saying, whoa, wait a second, if you go down this route before you know it, all of our money goes to supporting inefficient government programs. So I've really come to see that our basic reasoning is so flawed and so devoted to proving ourselves right that no one person or no one group can see everything. We start off with certain predilections, and then we look for justifications, and we find them. And the only cure for that is another party, which is saying, hey, wait a second, here's something you didn't see. So there are a lot of things like this. I mean, I think one thing I've been thinking a lot about recently is, you know, our budget catastrophe. I mean, we are headed for bankruptcy. We've got to cut spending and raise taxes. And the right is correct that entitlement programs are a disaster, and they're unaffordable, and you can't save Medicaid. It's just Medicare. It's just a question of when we're going to have to massively restructure it. They're right about that. But, you know, the left is correct that the Bush tax cuts were insane. They were completely unjustified, not paid for. So each side, each side is right about one major cause of our crisis, but then they're totally blind to the need to change their cherished element.
It is interesting to me, John, that you spoke earlier in the hour of starting this research feeling very much like a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, and now you have become, in your description, more moderate, meaning you've become somewhat more conservative. And I wonder if you feel like you are somehow outside of this. It sounds like the way you've described the shift in your beliefs is based on reason.
Well, yes, in a sense, although I would put it like this. I had all the partisan feelings for my whole life. I was a liberal from the time I was a teenager, and I went to Yale as an undergraduate, and I've been in the academic world, which is entirely liberal. So I was kind of overdetermined to be a liberal. And I started, because of my research, I started listening to conservatives. And it's not just that I, you know, sort of followed their logic and said, oh, they're right. It's rather that I got to know some, especially when I was in India. That was the real breakthrough for me, being in a village, a town, a city, really, in which people are religious, traditional, everything is segregated by sex. And I didn't just, you know, go in there and say, oh, they're so terrible and sexist and hierarchical. I was trying to understand them, and they were really nice to me. So when you have relationships with people, basically, if you open your heart first, that opens your mind. Hmm. So it wasn't just, that I encountered some reason. It was that I sort of tuned myself up by developing some friendships. And then it took a long time. So it wasn't until until I finished Chapter 8 of my book that I actually had the guts to come out and say to people, okay, I'm no longer a liberal. My ideas were already centrist several years before that, but I was still a member of the tribe, and it took a long time before I could say, you know what, how can I call myself a liberal when I really think that the truth is on both sides equally?
Did that experience cause any social isolation for you from the people that had felt like you were part of their tribe before?
It wasn't too bad. That's what I was afraid of, I think. That's probably why it took me so long to come out of the closet, as it were. And I gave a talk at a conference of social psychologists saying, you know, that we're almost all liberal in this field, and it limits us in some ways. I mean, our research is generally very good, but on politically sensitive topics, I think things don't quite work right. And there was some pushback. There were some people who thought that I was a traitor, but not very many, actually. I think people already knew me. People knew that I wasn't out to, I wasn't fighting for the conservative side. I've always disliked George Bush. I think he was a terrible president. And in part, as long as you say things like that, and I really do mean it, if you say, I hate George Bush, well, then people will give you a pass on saying, maybe conservatives are right about some things. Because you know, I didn't sort of go over inside with the enemy. I just sort of stepped out of and said, you know, I want off of this team. I want to be on the sidelines and really look at everybody.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Austin on the line in Dallas. Hey, Austin.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
All right, hey, so, you know, first of all, I'm kind of with you on the whole Bush thing, because I used to be really anti him, even though I'm a Republican, which is different than a conservative. But I met him one day, and after having him explain things to me, you know, when you become president, you get a whole bunch of crazy, just classified information, which changes your perspective. And when I learned that, I rethought my stance on him. And I have a question related to you. Earlier in the beginning, you were talking about life experiences from a teenager explaining their story and how that ties into the beliefs on government. And so I'm looking, and I'm curious if you can answer this. You know, in that balance of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, where you believe government's the answer versus individuals, or a conservative where you want to micromanage and enslave everyone to some moral standard, or Democrat where everyone should help everyone, you know, what are the experiences that gear people one way or the other? What have you seen? Have you detected anything?
Huh. That's a very good question. So first, briefly on Bush, I should not have said hate, in that I'm sure he's a very decent man. And he faced tough circumstances. I do understand that. I do hold him responsible, though, for pushing the nation into war. I'm sure the intelligence was mixed, but it was a disastrous decision, which we did not need to make. And basically, it emboldened Iran. It strengthened Iran and weakened us terribly. So I do blame him for that, and also the tax cuts, which have also crippled us in terms of our vigor in our fiscal position. As for your question about what life experiences cause people to change, so I think there's little research on this. Foreign travel tends to make people more liberal, people who are exposed to more ways of being. And they see things from more perspective. That tends to make people more liberal. And it is significant that Bush did very, very little foreign travel, certainly compared to either Clinton or Obama, who spent a lot of time abroad. So foreign travel makes people more liberal. But having children, raising children, and then also running a business, those things make people more conservative. And as people get older, they tend to get a little more conservative, although people move both ways. So life experiences really can change your view, you know, as they did with me and as they've done with you. So, you know, a lot of us aren't just members of one group our whole lives, even if our brains kind of push us one way or the other.
The last thing I want to ask you is what we can do to cultivate understanding of people who do not share our beliefs.
What a wonderful question to end on. Thank you, Chris. So the worst thing to do is just stay in your bubble, in your echo chamber. Americans have moved into what are called lifestyle enclaves. Much more than our grandparents, we can surround ourselves with people who think like us. We have cable TV channels and websites that support our prejudices. So our culture is kind of pulling for us to isolate ourselves and misunderstand each other. What you can do is cultivate relationships. If you know some conservatives, all of us are related to people on the other side. So whichever side you're on, if you know some people who are on the other side. And I hate to put it this way, but you know, if you read my book first, and you get you get some ideas about what's motivating each side, you could start a conversation with them that starts not as a challenge, not as a why do you think this, but rather as, hey, I read that you guys value this. What do you think? Is that true? So if you have to think about the context of a conversation. If you're having a conversation with a stranger on the internet, it's going to be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're tied together by family, by friendships. And you're actually curious. This is the thing I really most want to get across. Once you step out of your bubble, it's really, really interesting. I mean, there's vast realms of thinking and ideas and scholarship that you never even were exposed to. So it can be really interesting and fun. But you have to think about the personal relationships first. There's a website, there's a group called livingroomconversations.org. And they try to set up dinner parties, basically. If you have a liberal and conservative who are friends, they then decide to host a dinner party, and they each invite some of their friends. And as long as they set the tone, and you share food, sharing food is really important.
Mm-hmm.
it opens your mind.
Jonathan Haidt is professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and visiting professor of business ethics at NYU's Stern School of Business. His new book is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. John, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all of you listening this afternoon. Thanks especially to those of you who have made financial contributions throughout this hour by going online to KERA.org and by calling 1-888-694-6931. You may have heard us mention earlier that we have copies of John Haidt's book, which is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. That's available with a contribution at or above the $120 level. Jeff Whittington is back with us. He's senior producer of this show and, of course, host on Fridays of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. What a fascinating conversation. I want to thank everybody who has called 888-694-6931. We'd love to thank you if you call right now, 888-694-6931. I want to thank everyone who's gone online to kera.org, made a contribution there. You know, you can see all the thank you gifts that are available when you go online to kera.org. There are a variety of really cool thank you gifts this time, a new KERA t-shirt. There's all kinds of stuff. There are books from Rick Steves. Our guest book is available online when you make a $120 contribution. But please do your part right now. We're hoping to wrap this drive up in record time, and we can only do that if you go ahead and make your contribution right now.
It's always lovely to meet you out in person in different places, and you let us know what you love about the show. You let us know what you think we ought to change about the show. We love to have those conversations. And I am always happy when you acknowledge that you're also a contributor to KERA, because the reason that we're able to be on the air and bring you guests of the caliber we have is because of contributions from people who listen, who value civil discourse and the exploration of ideas, and really want to look at things from an objective perspective, which is something that we really try hard to do here. Your contribution now to KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931 makes this vibrant community resource possible.
It really is up to you. The station exists and has existed for several decades simply because other people, other listeners, maybe you, but maybe not you yet. Other folks have made it a priority, have just taken a moment, just given a few dollars each year to KERA to make sure that this station and this resource continues to exist right now for them, their friends and family, and for you. If you have not contributed, other people have contributed, and that's why you've been able to listen to KERA. That's why you've been able to participate in conversations like the one that Chris just had with Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind. And you can pick up your very own copy of Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, when you join the station with a $120 contribution. And hey, if you want to make that a little easier on your budget, become a sustaining member. You can set it up to be an automatic transfer of $10 a month, either from your bank account or from your credit or debit card. It's really easy to do. All the details are online.
And so many of you find that you can do, if you do a sustaining membership, maybe not 10, you can do 20 or 30 or even $50 because it doesn't feel like a giant chunk out of your budget. You make what is a really substantial contribution quite affordable for yourself, which is terrific to do. Of course, you can also make these contributions with a credit or debit card as well. And you can do that going online to KERA.org, where we also have a list of other thank you gifts if you're interested, or you can call us at 1-888-694-6931. Let us know once again that you like the idea of these short fundraising campaigns. We like them too, but we can only continue doing this with your help, with your quick action to our request for your support.
Yeah, I would be remiss if I didn't suggest that you check out the Nina Toten bag. there's also, I believe, the Susan Stamm bag, which is a tote bag. Each of those, one features a picture of Nina Totenberg. The other has Susan Stamberg. You can't go wrong.
You can carry your cranberry sauce in it.
I guess you could. Once you get the recipe, which we'll get a couple of weeks after the election.
Yes.
888-694-6931 is the number to call. Or check out those thank you gifts. Go online. Make your safe and secure, quick and convenient contribution at kera.org. Coming up, a conversation about adolescence and sleep and sleep deprivation. It's going to be riveting. You're going to want to listen to this, especially if you have kids in the house. It's going to be really great, and we're really excited about that. So take a moment right now and make your contribution. You'll be on and off the phone in just a couple of minutes, and you'll have the satisfaction of knowing that you've done your part for KERA.
You can go to kera.org online to make your contribution, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931. Public radio, of course, is here because we all come together, because we say that it's important, we value it, we rely on this station, and I say we because Jeff and I are in this group as well. We rely on this station for news, for information, for entertainment, and so we all decide that it is worth a few dollars a month, a few $100 a year, perhaps. The average gift is about $120 a year over the course of a year, but many of you give a great deal more. Some of you need to give less. We understand completely, but we do ask that everybody who, like you, values the station makes a contribution at least once a year to KERA.
Yeah, I mean, you can make an extra contribution. You can make a contribution during each of the three drives if you'd like to. I mean, that's absolutely fine. And you know what? Many of you do, and we really appreciate that. But if you have not yet made your annual gift to KERA, maybe you've never made a contribution to KERA, this is a perfect opportunity right now to call the number 888-694-6931. Again, it's 888-694-6931, or click and join online at kera.org.
Thank you so much for your support. Again, that number, 888-694-6931. Even easier to go online to kera.org.